Morning again, everybody. I'm Perry Ayers, and I'm... Okay, I... Can you hear me? I'm Perry Ayers, and I'm an alcoholic, among other things. It's good to be here. I'm waiting for the room to fill up. If it gets full enough, I'm going to give my talk on humility. Would somebody go out and announce that in the corridors? On the program, I noticed that the speakers who preceded me this morning were not assigned a topic, including Jay, who asked me to participate, and who did assign me a topic. Now, I am still just a tad paranoid, and I think that might be because he's heard me talk before, or perhaps he talked with my wife, who once told me that if anybody asked me my name, I was good for 15 minutes. So, when I give AA talks, I usually announce that the length of my talk is limited by the capacity of my bladder, and inevitably somebody says, give him a cup of coffee. The topic Jay assigned to me was the 12th step. So I thought about this, and I thought what I would do this morning was give you an interpretation of the psychosocial implications of the 12th step. And then I thought again, and thought I'd better not do that, so I thought I'd give you a recitation of my experience in carrying the message to hordes of alcoholics for the greater good of mankind. I decided that probably was not what he had in mind, and I decided to tell you something about what the 12th step has meant to me. It was appropriate that this was assigned after the movie, My Brother's Keeper. I've seen that movie several times, and it's a very moving production, and I hope those of you who haven't seen it will see it this afternoon. So I sort of structured my thinking as a sequel to the movie so that I could avoid having to tell you what a mess I made of my life. I could just refer to the doctor in the movie because there are considerable parallels. 12th step begins having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's a very heavy phrase, and I understand they debated the meaning, the wording of that phrase, and resolved the conflict by settling on spiritual awakening to designate the concept of conversion. Having had a conversion experience, you might have said, or I understand some people wanted to call it a psychic experience or a personality change. It's important for me to think of it that way and to think that it occurs as a result of these steps. To me, it means a gift of honest self-awareness and a conscious contact with God as I understand Him. Two things that I was lacking at the time that I got into difficulty. In order for you to understand the change, I think it's important for me to tell you something about how the change came about. So I will start at the end of that movie, essentially, and tell you a little bit about what happened 7 years ago this minute. I was midway through a two-month stay in a state mental institution, and when I tell about this, I usually say that where I had gone involuntarily. I don't know very many people who walk up to state hospitals and knock on the door and ask to be let in. I was admitted there in handcuffs with no knowledge of why I was there, very little recollection of the admitting process, except I do remember having the handcuffs on, and I remember trying to put my knee in the groin of a cop. He was more agile than I was. I nearly fell down, and he dodged. A very painful experience. My release from that hospital a month later, around Labor Day of 1974, was conditioned upon my willingness to surrender my license to practice medicine in the state of Ohio. My sole identity at that point was as a physician. I don't like the term that I guess Max Wiseman invented, that we're to the effect that we're awarded the MD-ity when we graduate from medical school. As I look back on this now, I didn't think of myself as a god, but my doctorhood, my physicianhood, served me as a cloak, as a shield. I had a caduceus shield that protected me from you. So long as I had my doctor coat on, I could relate easily because you could see me as a physician. I did not dare see myself or let you see me as a person. And that was the essence of my difficulty. When I left that hospital and surrendered my license, and I had already surrendered my DEA license for reasons that I won't go into detail about, but having to do with the use of small quantities of Demerol. Never used, I really didn't understand why they were so upset about that. I never used more than 2,000 milligrams a day. Every day. So how does an alcoholic... I had worked through the Demerol addiction and substituted Tolvin. And then I had worked through and stopped the Tolvin with some difficulty and had substituted the legal drug, the socially accepted and promoted drug, alcohol. And that's what had me in trouble in the state hospital. This was my fifth psychiatric admission, and it was no more effective than the others, except for the fact that they insisted that I surrender my license to practice before I could be discharged. So how does any confirmed alcoholic deal with the pain of an experience like that? I got drunk and stayed drunk for the next 3 months. And I won't give you any details about that, except that long before I got help, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew that my life was unmanageable. I was unemployed, unemployable, but I also knew every day, every evening, I knew that tomorrow, mañana, I would straighten up and everything would fall back into place and life would go on as before. And no way was that going to happen, and the deterioration progressed. I can remember practically the moment of my last drink. I was going to say I can almost taste it. I guess that might be true. Around noon on December the 14th, a Saturday morning, or Saturday, in 1974, a couple of people appeared in my home. I had already taken the geographic cure and had lived in a community away from my usual home for 3 years because I had surrendered my DEA license and had to close my office because I couldn't serve my patients properly without that, and I certainly did not dare tell any of my colleagues that I was without that license. They might think there was something wrong with me. And I had gone to a small community in southeastern Ohio where I had served as a consultant for about 25 years. And they offered me an opportunity to operate a cardiology consultation service there. And I made it clear to the doctors there that in order to avoid any of these patients coming to me individually in order to keep from intruding in the relationship of those doctors with their patients, I would not write prescriptions. A very noble motive. And they bought it. And the situation worked out pretty well until my alcoholism became me the scandal of this small community. You see, I was an outland foreigner. I was a well-known doctor from the big city who had insinuated himself into that community, and I'm sure that there was a lot of consternation about just how I happened to be there at the apex of a pretty good career. Because very few people in Columbus knew of my difficulty. And the people in Athens, Ohio, where I moved, learned about it pretty quickly. So I was the scandal of the community, and they couldn't tolerate me, and they spit me out, which was, of course, to my advantage. It's been my privilege in recent years to assist another doctor in that community who was one of the good old boys. He was born and raised in that community and practiced there, and everybody knew he was an alcoholic, and everybody worked around him and tolerated him and let him die, or very nearly die. One of the few times that we were invited out to dinner in that community, this man and his wife appeared, and he was drunk when he got there, and after a few more drinks, he passed out with his face in his dinner plate, and they took him home. They tolerated that poor fellow until he almost died. Well, I hadn't intended to go into that. On December the 14th, two people appeared in my home. I was drunk at 11 or 12 o'clock in the morning. But they announced that they were there to help me. I don't remember much about the experience, but the man who was introduced to me said that when we were introduced, we shook hands and my eyes filled with tears, and I said, "Thanks for coming." Now, that's one of my experiences with 12-step work. That's the most important of my experiences with 12-step work, the 12th step that was done on me. He saw to it that I got into a hospital, and I became aware after I had been admitted to this hospital and my head had been dried out a bit. I was made aware of the fact that 33 old friends had been organized by a boyhood friend of mine who was a physician in Columbus. They had been organized as a sort of a rescue mission, a rescue party, to see to it that I had a chance to recover. These people had not just pledged money to make sure that there were no financial roadblocks. They had actually established a bank account to be certain that money would not stand in the way of my recovery. 33 old friends, not all physicians, mostly physicians, and not an identified alcoholic in the group. I have questions about a couple of them, but that's their problem. This was a great source of strength for me, because through that, you might say that I came to believe that a power greater than I was could restore me to sanity. I had hope. I realized that perhaps I didn't have to be this way. I realized that other people knew of my problem and were willing to help. And through the love and support of those people, I became aware that there was a power working in my behalf that was greater than I was. They transferred me from that facility. They have a 3-week program there, and I breezed through that in 4 weeks. And they transferred me to a place in New York The man who ran that first facility, Charlie H., who's a member of this organization, was an old friend of mine. As a matter of fact, we had done a little drinking together in years gone by. Charlie made me, sold this Smithers place to me on the basis of the fact that it was Billy Rose's old townhouse on East 93rd Street, and he told me what a fancy place it was. He also told me about the tough little lady who ran it, and he convinced me, and you know I believed it, that one of his counselors had been wanting to go over there and look at this Smithers operation. And so as long as I was going, Fred might as well ride along with me. And I did believe that. And Fred rode shotgun on me through the airports. And in the cab on the way into the to Smithers from LaGuardia Airport, I was half seriously thinking, now when we get to this place, Fred will go off to survey it, and I'll have a little time with the people, and I'll be able to explain to them that I am a high-class, interested physician from Columbus who is here, who has recently developed an interest in alcoholism, and I'm here to learn something about their program firsthand. They didn't give me an opportunity to do that. I'm telling you this because I want you to know how my mind was working at that time. Within 24 hours, I had noticed that not only were all of the patients chain smokers, but all of the staff were chain smokers as well. And I was appalled by this. I was offended. And so I took one of the nurses aside and explained to her that it is inappropriate for health professionals to smoke in the presence of patients. And they kept right on smoking. Short time later, I had noticed that not only were all of the patients using coarse language, which you would expect in a bunch of alcoholics, of course, they were all using coarse language, but the staff employed coarse language as well. So I took another nurse aside and explained to her that I had been the editor of a medical journal, that I respected our language as a tool of precision, and when we used coarse language, we blunted that tool and became less effective in what we were trying to communicate. She was a little British lady, and she said, "Perry, try not to be a doctor while you're here." Now, in the head, I knew that I shouldn't be a doctor, but I was still trying to reach for something that would make me a bit different from these people. I knew very shortly after I was admitted there that I was obliged to go into a small group of my alcoholic peers and tell them how I happened to come to this lowly state, how I happened to be there. In the other institution, I had already learned that the importance of being honest with myself and with other people, and so I was prepared to do that. I knew it was very important that I give an honest recital of how I happened to be there. They said, "You'll have 10 minutes. And in something very, very little less than 10 minutes, I did that. I assigned all of the blame, and I identified all of the stresses that were responsible for my alcoholism, and I did it very well. And when I was through, I sat back in anticipation, I think, of their shaking their heads and saying, 'My God, no wonder you drank,' or 'You poor fellow,' or perhaps a few words of commendation for my excellent presentation. Instead, the group leader said, 'Does anybody care to comment on what you've just heard?' And there was a neat little Irish lady from the Bronx, who was a fellow patient, sitting next to me, and she said it sounded like bullshit to me. There were about 8 people in that group, and they were unanimous in that opinion. There were 2 counselors, and they did not dissent. It is funny, and I find it funny too, but at the moment, it was devastating to me. I, the man who the day before had lectured to them about the use of coarse language, found his life altered by coarse language. Those words, bullshit, changed my life. Because at that moment, you see, I had given my recital with all of the honesty that I could muster. I was as frank and candid with those people as I could be at that time. And what I was saying with all of that honesty was coming out to other people as bullshit. And I knew at that moment there was something wrong with me. And that's the first moment that that dawned on me. It was the first moment that I became aware that I must change. I was naked because I had been stripped of all of my defenses. I had been stripped of my physicianhood by the citizens of the state of Ohio. My denial had been pretty well fractured by this time, my denial of an alcohol problem at any rate. I sure had a lot of denial in many other areas. And now my defense of projecting my difficulties on other people had been broken down. I was devastated, lonely. I felt these people didn't like me because they said that. And I wanted to retreat. I wanted to run. But the only thing I had going for me at that moment was that glimmer of hope that I had gotten through having experienced the second step. You see, I didn't ever take the first, second, or third step intellectually. I didn't ever work at them and consciously work them through. They happened to me. In 1979, I began looking back at my few years of sobriety, and I realized that I was right where Bill Wilson was in 1939. He had gotten sober in 35, and I had gotten sober essentially in 75. So I began comparing myself to Bill Wilson. Not really. But really what I was trying to do was figure out how Bill Wilson was able to accumulate and put on paper so much wisdom. And so I began thinking back over my 4 years and how I got to where I was in 79 from the chaos that I had been in 75. And I was able to see that pathway that they laid forth for us, that 12-step pathway. And I realized, and it's become increasingly evident to me since then, that those first 3 steps were something that I did not do consciously. Those happened to me, and I accepted what happened because I had no choice. So I went up from that devastating session knowing that I had to change and not knowing how to do that. I shared a bedroom with 5 other men in this mansion, and they were all out of the room, so I had it to myself. And I remember I lay down on my cot, and I didn't know how to deal with the pain that I was feeling, and I only knew one prayer, as is the case with so many of us. I had been not an agnostic, I had been an outspoken atheist. And if you didn't agree with me, I would back you into a corner and try to poke my finger in your chest and convince you of the rightness of my thinking. So I was alone. And I decided, they say we must have a conscious contact with God. So I decided to pray. And the only prayers that I knew were, "Now I lay me down to sleep." And that didn't seem very appropriate. And the Serenity Prayer, which I had mastered with difficulty. Let me tell you, it was not easy for me to remember that in those early days. My head was not working very well. I even had trouble reciting the Lord's Prayer for several months after I started going to AA meetings, and I was raised on it. At any rate, I said the Serenity Prayer over and over and over and over and over and over again and again and again. And there came, I don't know how many times I said it or how long I lay there, but there came a moment when I felt relaxed, when I felt a sense of peace. It seemed the lights were brighter, the sounds were crisper, the air felt headier, and I don't know whether I said it out loud or said it to myself, but I can recall very clearly the words, "It'll be all right if you'll just get out of your own road." Now, I could have read that third step prayer till I was blue in the face, and I had read it, and I'm sure that I know that I passed right over it. It had very little meaning for me. "God, I offer myself to thee," you remember. It goes on, "Relieve me from the bondage of self." And that's essentially what I did at that moment. But that happened to me. I didn't intellectualize it. I was not capable of thinking that clearly. But that happened to me because it had to happen to me. Then I began looking at that third step, and it bothered me because I knew that I am responsible for the conduct of my life. And to turn everything over to God and assume that it's going to work out is bullshit. So I looked at the steps more closely, and I realized the next word in that fifth chapter is number 4. And we were obliged at Smithers, as we are at many places, to do the fourth and fifth steps before we leave. We were told that our discharge from there was conditioned upon our doing the fifth step. I don't know whether that was true or not. And I really don't know what would have happened if I had refused to do the fifth step. I've often thought maybe they had a trap door with an alligator pit or something. Anyway, I complied. But I complied because I wanted to. I was motivated to. I wanted to change, and this told me how I could change. And so I worked at it. Now, I'm sure that I didn't do a very thorough job of the fourth step. But I did it as thoroughly as I could. I'm sure it wasn't very honest, but I did it as honestly as I could at that moment. And I went in to do the fifth step with a remarkable little man named Bob DeVere, who was a counselor there. And he had scheduled something like an hour. And I handed him my notes, and he pushed them back. I started to read from my notes, my fourth step notes. He said, "I don't want to hear that. I want you to read it and then tell me what that tells you about Perry Ayres." We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I liken that to eating an artichoke. We sat there and we would take those first little leaves off the artichoke with a little bit of sweet meat on them, and lo and behold, there'd be a fatter leaf beneath it. We'd take that leaf off with a little more meat, and there's another fatter one beneath that. And we kept trying to reach for that succulent heart of the artichoke. I don't think I've ever gotten there, but I've kept on working at that. At the end of the hour, he said, "We're out of time. You better come back tomorrow." And the next day we spent another hour, and I still hadn't finished all that I wanted to get out. And he said, "We're out of time, and that's all right. You don't need to come back because you've got the idea." I know now what he meant. I had found out that it was all right for me to look down inside there and take a look at what was in there. And it was all right for me to show somebody else what was inside there. I think it was in San Diego that we heard somebody, or perhaps in Washington last year, we heard somebody say that he was afraid to look inside because he wasn't sure there was anybody in there. And I'm not so sure but what that's where I was. And certainly if there was somebody in there, he was rotten to the core. I did that fourth step inventory and the fifth step and found out there was indeed somebody in there. He wasn't all that bad. You know, "Hello there. Where have you been? You know, haven't seen you for years. Been out of touch with you. How have things been going?" "Well, I got a few scars and bruises and warts on me, but here I am. And I'm ready to go to work whenever you are." And that's the feeling I had. I had something to build on. And so I started doing that. I was discharged from there and returned to Columbus. And started going to a step discussion meeting. And I've been going there ever since. I moved back to Columbus. I've been going there nearly every week for 6.5 years. We keep refining our understanding, our comprehension of the steps, one step each week. When we get to 12, we go back to 1 again and start over. And I always learn something in those meetings. And I learn it from people whose educational background doesn't compare with this, with the tremendous credentials that I have. When I went to Smithers, they had a 4-week program with a 3-week educational program so that you repeated the first week in your last week. A pretty shrewd move because you're not in very good condition to hear things the first week, and maybe you'll pick up on them the last week. It happened that the first step I heard discussed at the Smithers step lectures was the sixth step, and the last step I heard discussed was the sixth step. And when I got back to Columbus and started going to our step group, it was the sixth step. Somebody was trying to give me a message. You see, if I had been left to my own devices, I don't think I ever would have done the fourth and fifth steps. I'm filled with admiration for people who have been able to do this without guidance and without pressure. Somebody this morning mentioned procrastination. I suspect that's common to all of us. It certainly was one of my great problems. And I think I would have intellectualized that thing until I might have drunk again or whatever, but I would never have gotten it done had I not been pressured into it. So I'm very grateful that I was pushed. Well, I don't want to belabor this too much, but I thought a lot about the seventh step. It's the shortest one. First, let me tell you that as far as the sixth step is concerned, when I was planning, right while I was in Smithers, I was going to rewrite the book. And in fact, I had some marginal notations of things that I thought could be deleted. Fortunately, my memory is for that period is so bad, I can't remember why I was doing all that. But one of the things I would have deleted would have been the sixth step, and the other would have been the eighth step, the steps of readiness and willingness. Because they're unnecessary. I didn't understand why they didn't just limit this to 10 steps. And if my thinking had gone on that way, I might have gotten it down to 0. You know, I might have eliminated them altogether. At any rate, I now recognize the sixth step as a very important sort of annealing or curing process. Am I ready? Do I really want to give up my defenses, the things that have served me well through all these years? My pride, my anger, which keeps people away. Do I really want to let go of these things? And the sixth step says we were entirely ready to have God remove these. The seventh step is important to me because it's a platform from which I can begin to straighten out the chaos of my life. Humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. The word humility there has been troublesome for a lot of my peers in AA and for me. I've come to believe, come to interpret that for my purposes this way. From a posture of honest self-awareness, I ask God to remove my shortcomings, because that's what humility means to me. Being honestly in touch with myself, and I keep striving for that. So I set about doing the eighth and ninth steps and trying to repair my relationships. And I have not completed that job. Doubt that I ever will. Things keep coming up that I hadn't thought of before. I rushed out and did some ninth step amends making very quickly after I got back from treatment, and I've had to go back and redo those. They didn't work out so well because I wasn't ready to do that. They number the steps for a reason, and I hadn't gotten that far yet. You see, one of my problems with the eighth and ninth step is that in a disturbed relationship with somebody else, I want to be able to say, yeah, but, you know, I acknowledge my role in this, but you dirty son of a bitch. Yeah. And I want to rub your nose in what you did to me. Well, there was one of those that's bugged me for several years that I knew I had to make. I had to go and acknowledge my role in what had happened between us. And the son of a gun died last spring. I'll never have the opportunity to do that directly. Then I found out that they gave me the tools to maintain myself day to day. And I work at that. I don't work at it in a structured fashion, but I do work at it, and it has helped me in the process of change. I continue that personal inventory, and I really try. When I'm wrong, I really try to admit it. It isn't easy. I gotta confess, it isn't easy. But I'm getting better at it. And then the longest step, the 11th step, and I work hard at this one, and I'll tell you how it helps me. You know how it helps me, but I'll tell you what is important to me from this step is that I try to reduce the situations I find that are troubling me to the point where I can ask only for strength and guidance, knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Oftentimes, in the process of reducing these situations to those simple requests, the problems disappear. If I look at them honestly and sit down and think about them, meditate about them, pray about them, the problems just simply resolve themselves. They aren't there anymore. They were phantoms. They were problems within my head. And they've gone away as I thought about them more clearly and took the time to address myself to them. But when they don't go away, then I do turn them over. And I am developing increasing faith based on personal experience, which is the best place I know to get faith, increasing faith that if I do turn things over after I have taken responsible action to resolve them and have failed, that by golly, they always work out. I mean 100%. They work out in a way that I can accept them. Sometimes they work out in a very spectacular way, and I could document that for you in a few instances where my expectations were unrealistically low, and when I got out of my own road, the situations worked out better than I would have anticipated. Most often, they're not quite what I might have wanted, but they're always something that I can live with. And I am gradually and developing a willingness to accept what comes that way and a faith that things will work out. So that brings me back to the 12th step, which I was supposed to talk about. And I've now disposed of that heavy phrase that introduces this step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I like to emphasize three little adjectives in this long sentence. Remember, it is one sentence. And what comes in the second and third parts of this sentence are predicated upon that phrase at the beginning. But the three little adjectives are the, this, and these. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. I pondered over that, and I must confess that early on, and still to some extent, I wanted to rush out and lecture to everybody about alcoholism. You know, I wanted to go into the bars and kick them off the bar stools and grab them by the lapels and tell them what all had been happening, how great it was. And I knew, and I know now, that that was not what I was supposed to do. But I wondered what the message was, the message of sobriety. It took me a while for it to dawn on me that in the first part of the fifth step, it says our stories revealed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. Now, I had a lot of trouble with that general way, too. I work in a psychiatric hospital where I see a lot of alcoholics who are admitted for treatment of their depression, never for their alcoholism. And I have occasion to confront them, and I'm permitted to do that by the people I work with. And so I sometimes try to lecture to them, try to describe alcoholism to them, try to accuse them of alcoholism. You know, when you confront a sick doctor, we didn't get into this last night in the Alcathon, but my experience in confronting sick doctors has been the first question is, who's accusing me of this? A real moralistic interpretation. Occasionally they'll respond with gratitude, the way I did. Thank God somebody cared enough to come. I couldn't do it myself, and I'm glad somebody came to help me. At any rate, I pondered over what this message is, and it is the message of what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. So we will sometimes wax very enthusiastic and tell people details of my story. And oftentimes I see them sort of sitting back in the chair, and I can sort of hear what's going on in their head. Well, if I have to be that bad, I might as well go back out and drink some more. And many of them do say, well, I've never had troubles like that. So then I have to back off and talk about identify, don't compare, and use the old cliches. But I've learned to be more general and to talk about the feelings that I experienced, the isolation, the loneliness, the guilt and the shame, the frustration, the consternation, and all of the things that went with my chaos. And then to tell them what happened and how I am now. And I try to demonstrate that to them by smiling a lot and by having a lot of little slogans around on my walls. At any rate, that's the only message I have. I've learned that. That's the message. That's the only one I have to give to any other alcoholic. And the last part of the step says, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, many of you have read the big book a lot more thoroughly than I have and probably remember it better because you're younger or you weren't as bad as I was. All of these steps, having changed as a result of this process that we went through, and I don't remember that they actually spell out principles that I can live by. I was raised with the Ten Commandments, and I was a Boy Scout, trustworthy, friendly, loyal, all that stuff. I always had sets of rules to live by. And here they talk about these principles, and they don't list them for me. And that was troublesome. But then I realized again that this is part of a long sentence. And the first part of that sentence says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, having changed as a result of this process that we went through, tried to practice these principles. Now, what that's come to mean to me is that I have evolved a set of principles that I try to live by. Principles that have meaning to me because I evolved them from the chaos that I was in and in the painful process of changing. I have principles that I try to live by. They may be the same principles that you have evolved. They may not, too. I don't know about that. Then that isn't important. The importance is these have meaning to me that I would not have gotten if somebody had put them in a list. They have meaning to me because I've worked them out myself. I'm enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm enthusiastic about working with other alcoholics. I enjoy working with other physicians, having problems related to substance abuse or to depression or whatever. Anything that impairs a physician's ability to live a full life. I am chairman of... I have my licenses back. The only licenses I had in 1974, curiously enough, number one was my driver's license. It had been in serious jeopardy, but I didn't lose it. I still had my marriage license, and I still have it. I still had my dog license. That all my other licenses were gone. Now I have them all back. I'm a whole person again. I have my physicianhood back, and I wear it properly, not as a defense or a shield. And I'm leading a comfortable life. I do enjoy the work. I started to say that I'm chairman of our Impaired Physicians Program. We call it the Physician Effectiveness Program in Ohio. And that's a labor of love. Because, you see, I remember that in 1975, 33 friends, most of them doctors, cared enough about me to give me a chance, give me another chance. So I'm dedicated to helping other people have another chance. I've been on the faculty of Ohio State University College of Medicine for 30-some years. And since I came back, my faculty appointment was never canceled. I'm a clinical professor in the departments of medicine and preventive medicine. And since I came back, I have made it clear to those that I worked with at the university. I've made no attempt to hide my problem for them. Let's say it that way. I'm not anonymous there any more than I am anywhere else, I guess. And from time to time, I have the privilege of talking to groups of medical students about alcoholism and substance abuse, and especially about their personal risk. And in view of the program yesterday about educating students regarding alcoholism, frankly, I think we should be educating them more about their personal risk than about the disease alcoholism, but that's, I guess, both things need to be done. I want to tell you that in 1978, I was privileged to talk to the medical students just entering the school that summer during their first week in medical school. That was 40 years after I had sat in the same situation right here and right down the street here in Cleveland. 40 years after I entered medical school, I had the privilege of talking to these young people, and I'd like to close what I have to say with the words, approximately the words that I used to close that talk. I gave them a caveat and a benediction. I said something to this effect: you are at risk because of the kind of profession you are entering, because of the kind of people you are, and because of the kind of people we, your teachers and colleagues, are. So from 40 years away, I offer you this benediction. Remember, you were a person before you were a doctor. Temper your dedication and learn to play, to give to yourself in healthy ways. Be a giver, but also learn to receive. Be alert to problems among your peers in this brotherhood of medicine, and reach out to your fellows. Be your brother's keeper. Thank you for listening to me.
Perry, I want to personally thank you for a marvelous and moving story. It really got me because I could identify with that problem you were having with Smithers and that compliance, the little technique of compliance anyway. And the Serenity Prayer was the opening gate to my sobriety when I was at Hazleton. It finally made some sense. But it took some time, and I had an awful time reading. I used to have to sit and read it off the wall. I couldn't memorize the thing. I thought something had happened to my brain, but it turned out this was just the old denial factor there. I like to sum up the steps of the program myself as three simple little phrases: find God, clean house, and help others. Won't you join me in the Lord's Prayer? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, the glory, forever and ever. Amen.